Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Frankie Babes.
Wow, somebody had a Wheaties this morning.
How are you doing, Francis? I'm great.
I'm all right. You know, I want to comment on a little change in a policy on a restaurant in New York.
It's not a little change.
It's the last.
It seems a little change, but it's not.
It's the last one, though.
It is the end of an era.
The 21 Club is a famed New York restaurant that's been around since Prohibition in the same spot. And it was the power lunch place in the 50s, 60s, 70s, or 80s. And it's not quite the power lunch place it was, but it still is, you know, a power lunch. A lot of those titans of industry not doing as well as they were, especially the banking industry. And 21, which is unapologetically expensive for good food. It is good food, and it is a great wine list.
Yeah.
But it's not a bargain, and it's not about paying for truffles and foie gras. It's about paying for being at 21.
It's
called the 21 Club, but you don't go there. You're like, you go to 21. You have your regular table at 21. You're meeting the girls at 21 for lunch, right? And the 21 Club was one of the last places in New York to require a necktie.
Mm-hmm.
That is until the end of last year. They no longer require a necktie. Gentlemen are still required to keep their jackets on.
To keep their jacket, not just wear a jacket, to keep it on.
So no taking it off and hanging it over the back of the chair.
There was just an article in the Times I mentioned that there are still 13 places in New York City that require a jacket.
Do they require that you keep your jacket on?
I don't know that they require that you keep it on, but you must wear a jacket. And actually, that
only
takes
13?
Me back. Years ago, only 13, yeah.
Wow.
Years ago, we went to 21 together, you and I and some groups from an organization we belong to called the Red Meat Club.
Oh, yeah. We'd
celebrate lunch at one steakhouse or another. We went to 21. And I will never forget a couple of the chefs and restaurant people that we were with didn't have jackets.
Right. And
or
these
ties.
And these were New York chefs.
Some people didn't have jackets or ties. And I recall, as a matter of fact, of somebody who's a dear close friend whose name I'm not going to use, who we are still very friendly with, did not have a jacket with him and went around the corner and bought a jacket.
That's right.
And so we waited for it. We were about half an hour late for our reservation because people were scrambling to get jackets and ties.
To walk further down memory lane, am I correct in stating that at that time Michael LaMonaco was the chef at 21?
That's exactly right.
Has moved on since then. But
that's
he was
exactly
a
right.
fairly new chef at 21. Mm-hmm. And what I recall is we were having lunch in the upstairs dining room, which is not actually as cool as being downstairs, but it was sort of the private upstairs. And we just made a reservation for a bunch of us for lunch. And then he noticed that we were there, and then he cooked for us.
He stopped
our meal in the middle. And remember how I said it wasn't about the food? Well, it was today. And he came out and he carved stuff tableside for us. Mm-hmm. What a wonderful meal we had.
Really was a special meal, but I will never, emblazoned in my memory is a couple of people who were in the know about New York restaurants walking in there and just kind of forgetting that they had a jacket and tie policy.
Well,
one person without a jacket and a couple of people without ties.
Well, they nixed the tie policy at lunch a couple of years ago, I think, but not at dinner. And now they've just nixed it completely, and they're suggested. But you know what the fact of the matter is? Here we are in 2009, and their base has suffered a great deal. And the New York Power Lunch, and frankly, I think that people aren't so concerned about being conspicuous consumers right now that you need to be seen at 21.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the food. I don't know what they've done with their prices, but I think that right now, if you're looking to go to 21 and you've got the money in your pocket, you can pretty much go there.
Well, also, let's face it. You can be fairly well dressed up and not be wearing a tie in this day and age. I mean, fashion has changed to the point where you can be wearing some very nice clothes and not be.
We were having lunch a couple of years ago with the editor-in-chief of GQ magazine.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly
and,
right.
Okay, we're having lunch with the editor-in-chief of GQ magazine in our restaurant, and he was talking about a restaurant in New Jersey, which will leave nameless.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to this restaurant with his friend, editor-in-chief of GQ magazine. As you might imagine, he was well-dressed. He's always well-dressed, right?
Always well-dressed.
And he walked into this restaurant, and they had a jacket required. And he just was... He said, I walked in, and we were very well-dressed, and they turned me away, and I thought, okay... I'm looking in the dining room at people that look ridiculous in their polyester jackets.
Sure, somebody's wearing a polyester suit that cost them $79.
And I am dressed very well. Okay, I'm not dressed casually, but I don't have a jacket on. Well, it wasn't a formal jacket. It wasn't a sport coat. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't seat him. And he thought, fine, I don't want to be in here. And okay, that was the editor-in-chief of GQ magazine. And you turn him away, and the reason I use him as an example is, who knows who else you've turned away?
Mm-hmm.
And it's harder and harder to enforce a dress code. It really is.
It is. As restaurant owners, I can tell you that it's a difficult thing to do.
And I'll tell you that we do have a dress code at Stage Left, and it's at the discretion of the maitre d', and some people have gotten mad. We discourage jeans in the dining room, but we allow some jeans in the dining room. Look, you come in, mm-hmm. wearing nice jeans, you're very well-dressed, and here's the rule. If you've gone out, say the couple who's gone to the ballet and they've gone out for a very special night and they're dressed to the nines and they're sitting in the dining room. If you
don't want to be sitting next to somebody in a tank top and flip-flops.
Right, exactly. And you can sit next to someone in, you know, really nice jeans and a nice sweater, mm-hmm. but you know the Joan Jett concert t-shirt person sitting next to you is going to ruin what you have set
up. I don't know if they're going to ruin it, but they're certainly going to make it feel like a less special occasion.
Well, because we've spent so much on the aesthetic of the room. They're spending a lot on dinner to be in the aesthetic of that room, which is, let's dress up for an elegant occasion. And if you come in tank top and flip-flops, then you're ruining the aesthetic of the room that it's a special place. What you're saying is, this is not a very special place. But
well,
I think,
you know what, I think it's more than that even. And I'll tell you, while I don't agree with 21 Clubs that everyone needs a tie, because I think you can be very nicely dressed without a tie, I do think that there's a certain amount of respect for others when you get dressed up, when you get dressed up to go to the theater, when you get dressed up to go to a nice restaurant, that it's not just about, and I think that as the generations have evolved over the last 30, 40 years, there's been less of a focus on how I'm perceived than how I feel about myself. And yes, it's important to feel good about yourself. It's important to be who you are. But at the same time, have we lost that sense of, you know, the respect for other people? And I just think that dressing up for the theater is a respect for the actors as much as it is for yourself.
Well, and for the other folks in the establishment.
And for the other people in the theater. That's exactly right.
And one of the things that's become more difficult is what is the definition of what is dressed up has changed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a tough line to call. Anyway, we could go on like this forever, and we probably will after.
There's a car ride on the way home.
So we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC, and restaurantguysradio.com. I would like to announce the most exciting new project Mark and I have launched in years. We've teamed up with some old friends, Mike and Jennifer Schnurr, and worked with our chefs and purveyors of artisanal food products to create RestaurantGuysChocolate.com. Yeah, baby, we've created a line of extraordinary and delicious chocolates in a palette of thoughtful and complex flavors. They're sexy, they come in a great, beautiful red box, they're handmade, and they make a perfect gift or a perfect personal indulgence. We ship overnight, or you can pick them up at the restaurants. The website is restaurantguyschocolate.com, or find the link at restaurantguysradio.com. We put our heart and soul into every box, and each one's made by hand. There's a little bit of my soul in every piece of candy, that's right, and a little bit of Mark's too. So check out restaurantguyschocolate.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Joining us today, our guest is once again our old friend, Dale DeGroff. Dale has a new book out, The Essential Cocktail, The Art of Mixing the Perfect Drinks, and I think it may be the best cocktail primer yet written.
Dale, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Francis. Thank you, Mark, Francis. Thank you for those kind words.
Now, we've had you on the show many times before, or several times before. You've been gracious enough to come and join us on the radio. And your last book, The Craft of the Cocktail, was a big seller, a big hit. It's on the back of every bar. Why a new book? What's different about this book, Dale?
Well, as you noticed, I waited a long time. I mean, I have my pals like Salvatore Calabrese seems to pop them out every 6 months. I don't know how they do it or where they come up with stuff to say, but I frankly didn't have much more to say until just recently.
Well, what did you figure out to say?
In the interim, I had a lot of new recipes coming down the pike of my own, as well as new interesting things and ideas in the business itself. A changing business is very rapidly changing, as we all know. And also the complaint about craft, although it was a good primer for young bartenders as well as home bartenders, was that there weren't enough pretty pictures of the drinks. So I actually got together with a young digital photographer named David Kressler, and David is brilliant. He never shot film, and he's a digital guy. He's got a studio in Manhattan and one at home. And I was delighted to, after working with him, that I found this person. If you shoot with a guy, no matter how good they are, a commercial photographer who grew up in film and then switched to digital, you know, they're always running back and forth to the guy sitting at the computer. Did we get it? Did we get it? You know, because they don't really know. But with a guy like David, who's Mr. Digital, I call him, he grew up and never shot film. He's only shot digitals. And he as the photographer, is the technician. He knows when he got it. He knows how light works and what the data should look like in order for it to be a beautiful photograph. So I'm very, very happy with the photographs in this book. They're stunning.
Well, like any recipe, knowing what it's supposed to look like when you're finished is an important part of building the recipe.
Totally, yeah. And people are, I think, happy to have it. They're happy to see the different kinds of glassware that are being used now. And were used in the 19th century. I went totally bonkers with glassware in this. I just searched up glassware from everywhere, antiques, new stuff, designer stuff, just so I could have a really broad array and give people lots and lots of glassware ideas.
Well, people may not realize, and I'll toot your horn for you a little bit here, Dale, is that you pretty much are more responsible, and this is not just me saying this, this is everybody who writes about spirits, says you're pretty much more responsible than anyone else for this cocktail renaissance, and it started with you at the Rainbow Room when Joe Baum had you at the Rainbow Room, and one of the things you did there was you had classic old glassware at the Rainbow Room, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. People hadn't seen that in years, because prior to that whole period of time when the cocktail was at a low ebb, it got to the point on the East Side, singles places in Manhattan, I called it the era of the one glass bar, where there were actually bars that used goblets for their highballs, for their rocks drinks, for their straight up drinks, and for their wine, all the same glass.
I'll tell you, Dale, I worked in a place that did almost exactly that. I mean, there were three or four glasses for everything.
Yeah.
You know, for every single drink in the place.
I remember when, because we've been friends a long time, and in the spirit of full disclosure, we should let our listeners know that we've been friends a long time, but I remember in the 90s, in the early 90s, I would come into the Rainbow Room bar, and a lot of people there, I mean, the cool kids on the block all went there for Dale's cocktails, and you sort of listened to the master, you know? But there were some people where you'd go, and they'd say, oh, see, that's not even a proper martini glass. And, of course, you would be using a historically correct martini glass, and it just wasn't the glass that they were used to.
Yeah, well, we had what I ended up calling the Nick and Nora glass, or the little martini glass, as the company who sold it called it. We had that for our retro cocktails, but we also had the classic V-shaped martini for our Manhattans and modern martinis. And we had London dock glasses. We had a small fizz glass. We had lots of different sizes of glasses for different. And we had a proper Irish coffee glass, which is, you know, something I really...
What makes a proper...
Well, you know, glassware will sometimes force the bartender to make a proper drink, and that's the use of a proper Irish coffee glass, because it doesn't allow you to overpour the coffee and hence drown the drink.
You know, this is a joke in my family. They say, you know, I'd like an Irish coffee. Do you have any coffee? Well, no, I don't have any coffee. All right, I'll have it without the coffee then.
Of course, don't we love that?
Now, with a classic drink glass, though, one of the things it also doesn't allow is overpouring. I'm always amazed when I go into a bar, and the two things that sort of don't work for me are when you pour me a 6.5-7 ounce martini in a very large glass, which is sort of fashionable today in those oversized glasses.
Yes, bad for the house, bad for bartender because you can't make a proper drink, and it's just
and it's warm by the time you're done with it.
Bad for the police.
Bad
for the neighborhood.
Yeah,
it's bad.
So,
people are getting over that, especially now with the economy going in the wrong direction.
Well, I mean, classically, a martini is what, about 3 ounces, right?
There shouldn't be more than 3 ounces of spirit. And if you have a 5.5 to 6 ounce glass, it fits perfectly in that size glass after you have the additional ounce or ounce and a half of melting that takes place, which is proper and needs to be there. So yeah, I think 5.5 to 6 ounces is the ideal size for any cocktail style or up drink. There are uses for those oversized martini glasses, like the 9 to 11 ounce ones, for very juicy style modern cocktails that still have a low alcohol content but have lots of juices in them. You know, there are reasons to have them, but not for your standard. And especially when you're using, as people are, calling for Grey Goose and very expensive spirits now, you use those overproof glasses, and you know, the owner always says, oh, well, we have our pour size. Well, darn well, that the bartender's going to fill that glass up. I don't care what size it is, because the guest is going to...
Tip based on that.
Of course. Yeah. So, you know, you can actually, because of the size of those glasses, your cost of sales can be more than, you know, than your... Or,
more
you know,
than the cost...
charging for the drink in some cases.
Exactly. So I've actually come up with a use for those oversized martini glasses.
What's that?
Shrimp cocktail.
Yes. Well, you know, just so people know what we do for most of our drinks are predicated, if it's all liquor with no juice or anything like that, if it's all hard liquor, we shoot for a 3 ounces of liquor that then winds up being 4 ounces of drink. And for drinks with a little bit of juice in them, there are 4 ounces of mixed drink that winds up after shaking being 5 ounces of finished cocktail. And that seems about right to me. I mean,
yeah, it's fine. I mean, I think people are finally getting the message. And what happened to me at the Rainbow Room was when I went from a 7 ounce glass down to a 5.5 ounce glass, after all the expected moaning and groaning, by the end of that year when we reviewed our average check and we're doing all of our math as you do at the end of the year, we noticed that our average bar cocktail, you know, liquid only cocktail check had gone 2.5 times what it had been when we went to the smaller glass.
Well, Dale, it's not just smaller glasses. It's anytime you're telling a story at the bar, nobody's leaving. Okay, that's the way it is.
Thank you. Now, speaking of bars, and aren't you amazed at what's going on out there now? It's just a new world. I think the DNA of the cocktail has actually been a change in the...
You know, it's funny. We were talking earlier about the idea that, you know, in 1992, when I first met you, when you started teaching us about cocktails, you know, you talked about a world in which, you know, cocktails are important and they should be part of a restaurant program and they should be made with fresh juices and fresh ingredients. Well, the future is now, man. I mean, the world is what you said it was going to be 15 years ago. How does that feel?
Oh, it's wonderful stuff happening. I call it the culinary cocktail, for lack of a better word for it, where we have finally really, in most high-end places, even some of your chain places, and some of your big hotel chains like the Marriott and their bar arts program have gone all the way with us now. They're using fresh juice, and they're making the big step into herbs and spices and savory ingredients. And the only problem is, of course, is that we're still working in 19th century bar layouts, and we're producing these 21st century drinks, and the bars themselves are not designed to accommodate certainly the additional garnish and the additional ingredient, for one thing, because those little plastic garnish tray delivery vehicles are just no longer appropriate for this guy.
We need more than 6 garnishes.
Upwards of 30 different garnishes and ingredients that have to be accommodated.
Yeah. You know, it looks kind of like the Garmanger station or the pantry station in the kitchen almost.
Totally. But what I've seen in Europe, which is being very successfully used, is those stacked refrigerated drawer units that you find under the salamander, where they keep the steaks and the fish fillets to be thrown onto the salamander when they're ready to be grilled, those work really nicely behind the bar, right next to the ice station and the sink, adjacent to the sink. My friend Salvatore is using it in his bar 50 in London, and the small drawer on top has all of his berries, herbs, and spices that need to be refrigerated. The second drawer has actually whole fruit, and the third larger drawer has splits of tonic and ginger ale and soda, which he likes to keep cold and obviously are much better than from the gun. And you know, I understand the economics of the gun. I'm not assailing the gun necessarily. I'm just saying that there are certain things that you should not load in the gun, ginger ale, tonic, and juice of any kind being most importantly the ingredients that should never be found in a soda gun. But he has solved the problem of cold garnish for a cold drink. You know, his olives and onions are also in that drawer. And yet he still has the old-fashioned tray where he keeps his wedges of lemon and lime and orange and those things that are going into drinks that have ice in them and don't necessarily need to have cold garnish, your highballs, etc. He's designed a new kind of sink where there's a sliding cutting board right on top and a very large drain hole, and everything goes right down the drain hole, and underneath is a big stainless steel bin that has a filter at the bottom. All the liquid goes through and the solids don't, and it takes a long night of very heavy business to fill this huge bin, and you just roll it out and empty it and replace it with another one.
That's great.
And what a brilliant idea, instead of dealing with clogged sewer lines and et cetera, et cetera. So the bar of the future, I think, is wide open for design changes. And I think you're finding young bartenders opening independent bars where they're using, you know, glass jars with tops on them, maybe 15 or 20 of them to accommodate their additional garnish, which is okay. But then you have to deal with the health department rules of covering, mm-hmm. and, you know, what happens when you get really busy, and can you keep them cold? And I also thought sushi bars should be reviewed and examined as possibilities for bar stations in the bars of the future because of those long refrigerated rails they have. There may be something there for us.
Yeah, I
think the thinking on this is wide open.
There is lots of opportunity, I think, to grow this as this industry grows to be almost mainstream. I definitely see it almost becoming mainstream. I just want to go back, and some people may not realize the type of refrigeration units that a lot of restaurants use in their kitchens that Dale was talking about. It's a refrigerator, but it's a set of drawers inside that refrigerator, so you're only opening the drawer for the things you need inside that refrigerator, so in order for it to maintain its cold a lot better.
It's a terrific, and I don't know why we can't start thinking like the chef does. The chef designs his kitchen totally on his needs to produce that menu. And I think we've got to start thinking of what our needs are at the bar to produce these exotic menus that we're coming up with. I was up at 230 Fifth Avenue the other day meeting with Steven Greenberg about a possibility of doing a couple of drinks for him up there. They're doing so much business. They're doing $10,000 an hour on their registers up there. And he's saying to me, well, we just can't do this and we can't do that. And I'm saying that to him, but what about the Bellagio, where Tony Albagano was doing 25,000 drinks a day? Don't tell me it's not possible. I know it's possible. It just takes a whole new approach. Now, in the case of Stephen's beautiful 230 rooftop bar and second floor below the roof bar, which accommodates large groups of people, maybe now, because it's all designed and finished, it's not possible to retrofit. But in the design of that bar, initially, if they had known they wanted to do specialty cocktails, they could have, I think, designed the facility into those bars so that they could accommodate, you know, $10,000 an hour going from those registers. That's a lot of drinks.
it's a lot of drinks, and it allows you to spend a lot of money on accommodations.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that's interesting is we haven't designed a bar specifically to be able to have a whole Grand Manger station at the bar, but we've allowed ourselves the flexibility to do that. When we designed, you know, our first restaurant, I remember, Dale, you did a cocktail dinner with us back in 1995 or 96, I think it was. Might have even been 94. And it was not. It was good to be able to do a couple of a cocktail dinner. And we had a cocktail list that we wound up abandoning because our cocktail list, we became a victim of our own success. Because our bar was so small, you just couldn't produce more than a few good cocktails. And you certainly couldn't produce a lot of fresh fruit cocktails.
There was certainly no room for 30 garnishes.
And you know, the bar was small. I couldn't send a second bartender back in there to help. There wasn't enough refrigeration. And this was an old 1930s bar. When we built Catherine Lombardi, we built it with extra refrigeration, extra space, extra ice bins.
Tabletops for bartenders to work and cut. And
it makes all the difference in the world. Just thinking about it in advance, you know, designing the space around the utility of what you need to do.
Well, we were lucky at the Rainbow Room. We were doing such high volume up there. But my front bar did not produce for the lounge. It only produced for the 16 stools that were at the bar. So we were able at the front bar to do everything in front of the guest, a la minute, completely fresh, ready to go. Not that the stuff coming from our service bar in the back wasn't done in that way. It actually was. The same fresh ingredients were used. But over the years, we figured out systems of batching the non-volatile ingredients so that you were just handling so fewer ingredients to get drinks out to the guests. Those 125 tables, 125 seats, or whatever we had, I can't remember, which turned over literally 7-8 times a night, and very complex drinks. So we figured it out, but it took us time. I mean, you know, it is possible. It just takes some creative thinking.
I want to, that you bring up a great subject, because people are looking both in the industry and at home to do this more. When you batch drinks, and I know that we do this, we do some cocktail catering, some bartending catering events, or when we're doing a large event and where we'll offer a couple of cocktails, we will partially batch the drink. What, in your estimation, can you batch, and what shouldn't you mix until the last minute?
Well, if you're going to batch and then serve immediately to a large group of people, you can make the drink complete,
right,
in my opinion.
But if you're going to hold, if you're going to batch and hold,
it all up. And that means putting the juices in and everything. And the beauty of that, of course, is that you're basically, it's easier to make a really good tasting drink for 190 people sometimes than it is for one, because you got that huge container and you just keep adding until you get it exactly the way you want it.
And then it's all consistent.
The sweet, the sour, the bitter, the strong, you just tweak it and tweak it until it's perfect. You know, that you have that luxury when you're batching like that, whereas when you make it in the glass in the shaker, it better be right for that guest right then and there. You don't have any room for mistakes.
What about, Dale, batching and holding? Batching in advance to be able to produce things quickly, you know, a la minute, as it were.
In advance for use through an 8-hour shift or even for the next day. If you're going to batch for the next day, there can be no juices present in the batch. If you're going to batch for that day for an 8-hour shift, the only juices that can go in are non-volatile juices like cranberry. My advice is to do all the liquor ingredients, the non-volatile ingredients, bitters, liquor, juices like cranberry, and then at the moment of service is when you grab that lime juice, lemon juice, pineapple juice, orange juice, grapefruit juice, whatever else needs to go in, whatever fresh ingredient, whatever infusion, infused syrups, or whatever you think might not stand up well in the batch can go in at the last moment, at the moment of service.
And that's because those juices lose power and freshness in the drink?
They'll change. They'll go bitter, and it'll affect the whole batch, and then you got to toss a lot of booze. So I would do, for example, we serve so many thousands of Cosmobombs a day at the Rainbow Room that what I ended up doing is gallon batches for both of the service bars and the Rainbow Room side and the bar side. And we do half a dozen of them and go through them easily in a night. And they included Cointreau, citrus vodka, and cranberry, mm-hmm. and in the proper proportion. And then at the moment of service, the fresh lime juice and the squeeze of orange oil from the orange zest, you know, at the moment of service.
And just for anybody who's listening, who's not a bartender, if you've ever had a fresh juice in your refrigerator, a fresh orange juice or a fresh lemon or lime juice, you see how quickly that juice changes in your refrigerator.
Let's talk for a minute, Dale, about the Cosmopolitan and your relationship to it. You have been credited with inventing the Cosmopolitan, and while that's not exactly right, you're responsible for its current formulation. Is that close to the truth?
We actually did. The actual inventor, a woman named Cheryl Cook, finally contacted my friend Gary Reagan, who's another cocktailian, and he actually invented the word cocktailian, who is an author and an interested party. And so Cheryl, who had left the bar world to become an exotic dancer and other things, did contact Gary to say that, yes, in fact, she had invented it some years earlier with roses, lime juice, and triple sec and other ingredients. I found the drink in the many, many different kinds of recipes that were floating around in the early 90s when I came across it as totally unsatisfactory, but I loved the name. So I just went premium with it, you know, made sure to use the Absolute Citron, which was the required vodka at the time, and they were the ones that did the trade marketing on the drink in the first place anyway, and commissioned the drink. Cointreau, because it's the best orange liqueur you can buy, good cranberry juice, not cheap stuff, and of course, fresh lime juice instead of the roses, and it was night and day. It made such a wonderful, pleasant drink. And then I flamed the orange peel over top, which nobody had done before. They usually just threw a lime wedge in there or something, some such thing. But it made the drink sexy again, you know, which is what it was always intended to be. It was intended to be by the Absolute people a drink that would appeal to women. Actually, it ended up appealing to women and men and pretty much everybody around the world. Since I think it's still one of the most ordered drinks in the world, next to now the mojito is really running a very close second.
But I would say, though, that, you know, that was really the first cocktail to gain widespread appeal and to be a craze, and you're responsible for the final recipe of perhaps the most ordered cocktail of the 21st century, or the late 20th century even.
Well, I'm going to give some more credit to another man named Toby Ciccini, who wrote the book Cosmopolitan. Toby, unbeknownst to me, was doing some of the same kind of altering to the recipe that I was doing when he worked down there on the Lower East Side.
Odeon, right?
That sort of painter's hangout.
Odeon?
Odeon.
Yeah, yeah.
And he did write a lovely book, which was more about his life than it was about the drink, of course, but a marvelous book which I actually tell young bartenders to read because of one story that he tells about going back to Italy to visit his the patriarch of the family, his mother's brother, and this wonderful moment when the old man, and he is sitting sort of in an awkward silence, and the old man said to him, "So, Tony, what are you doing?" And he says, "Well, I'm a bartender, but I've got some plans, you know." And the old man considers that for a minute, and he says, "That's nice. So, Tony, are you good at this? You're good at this bartending?" And Tony, "Yeah, I'm pretty good." He says, "That's nice," he says, "Tony. So, Tony, are you proud of the work do you do?" Now, Tony's like, "Oh, yeah, yeah, am I proud of the work I do?" "Well, you know, I guess so, you know." And, you know, and on the way back home, he's in the plane, and he's thinking, "Geez, you know," and just the words are reverberating in his head, and he says that's when he decided he was going to open Passersby, and that, yes, in fact, he was going to be a bartender. He didn't have any other plans for his life.
And he was proud of the work that he did.
And he was proud of the work he did, exactly.
Well, if you...
I like bartenders who are just still saying, you know, "Oh, you know, I got some plans, you know, I'm going to get this going and that going, I've got a lot of irons in the fire, you know, there's nothing wrong with this profession anymore, it is back."
I have to say, that's true of the culinary world, it's true of being a chef, it's true of being in the front of the house. And we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about this book, The Essential Cocktail, The Art of Mixing Perfect Drinks with Dale Groff. If you want to meet Dale, you're going to be over out at the restaurant doing a little cocktail party with us on the 20th of February. Yeah, 20th of February. So if you'd like to meet Dale, you can come out and do it at Catherine Lombardi. You can find out more information at CatherineLombardi.com. Or you can email us, francis@stageleft.com. We'd love to see you. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
Hey, Francis, what's your first choice of hotel in New Jersey?
Easy question, Mark. It's the Heldrich Hotel and Conference Center.
You stay there because it's so convenient, right across the street from the restaurants, right?
I stay there because it's awesome. The rooms are elegant and stylish and comfortable. The service is slick and professional and kind. Did you know they have a swimming pool and a full-service spa? You can get a foot massage.
You know you're a decadent guy, right?
I do, and that's why I stay at the Heldrich.
Well, I stay there for more practical reasons. It's right in the heart of New Brunswick, so you can walk to all the great restaurants and brew pubs and cafes and three world-class theaters. You can even catch the train to Manhattan and be there in less than an hour. And if you want to dine or have a drink in the hotel, Christopher's Restaurant and Bar is right there.
The Heldrich is also great for business. In our dining rooms, we meet a ton of people who book corporate events, meetings, and conferences there, and they're all happy. With 248 rooms, 14 suites, and over 25,000 square feet of state-of-the-art meeting and conference space, the Heldrich can do up to 450 for meetings, social events, and even great weddings.
On the practical side again, it's only 25 minutes from Newark Airport. There's a direct train from New Brunswick and frequent shuttles. How easy is that?
To plan a meeting or book a leisurely getaway, call the Heldrich at 866-609-4700. Visit theheldrich.com or click through the link on our website, ask for the Restaurant Guys promo, or online enter promo code Catherine to get a special rate just for our listeners. That's 866-609-4700, theheldrich.com, or click the link on Restaurant Guys Radio. The promo code is Catherine. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking today with Dale Groff, preeminent bartender of the world. His new book is The Essential Cocktail, The Art of Mixing Perfect Drinks. You know, when I look at this book, Dale, it solves a very serious problem in the world. We talked about how the world of cocktails has changed. And when we met, Mark and I both started as bartenders in this business, and now we're restaurateurs. And when we met, you were a bartender who'd been, you know, a New York barman, and then you went on to this thing where you looked into the history of things, you looked at restoring sort of the dignity of the cocktail itself, but you were always an experienced barman, and you knew the basic drinks, and we all sort of knew the basic drinks. What I'm experiencing now, and I'm curious if you're experiencing the same thing, I have a lot of bright young people who come to work for me. And I teach them how to be bartenders. And they start off learning how to make a blood and sand and all the drinks on my cocktail menu, you know. And they can make a hot buttered rum, and they can make, you know, all of these contemporary drinks that I have on my cocktail menu. But if someone comes in and asks for a rusty nail, they have no idea.
Or a grasshopper.
Or, yeah, what they're talking about. Because a lot of the young people who are coming in today
aren't coming in with that broader frame of reference, and it's and what I think your book does is it gives them that broad frame of reference.
Yeah, it'll cover the 100 basic sort of tricks that when I came into the business, because I got the end of the era, as some used to a certain extent, because I came in 69 to New York. There were a lot of old-timers around, and, you know, I worked in that advertising agency with a bunch of pretty good drinkers, and they were the ones who taught me about bars, and they were also the ones who were doing the advertising for Joe Baum and Restaurant Associates. So I was in contact at these great, great restaurants with some of the best bartenders that were around at the day, the Four Seasons, Four of the 12 Caesars, Charlie O's. And these guys knew, even though they may not have been doing mojitos and fresh juice drinks and things of that nature, although a few of them were doing pisco sours and things like that, they knew those drinks. They knew what a Presbyterian was, what a Stinger was, and how to make it properly. Tom Collins, all the drinks that sort of are now starting either as the classics that they were or as optional sort of variations on the classic are coming back to us, you know. And I believe that the problem is there is no great school or academy or culinary sort of America for the bartender where you can learn the basic sauces, you know. And that's what Beverage Alcohol Resources is, this partnership that I have formed with Steve Olson, David Wonders, Doug Frost, Paul Packard, Andy Seymour, Paul Packard. These guys, we're dedicated to getting as much information out to bartenders around the country, and we're working through this wonderful program with Pernod Ricard called Bar Smarts that can interact online. So even bartenders in a small town in Iowa can get the benefit of this knowledge, you know. And that's what we need. We need more education. I think a lot of the big suppliers are dedicated to doing that.
Well, in the wine world, there's been primers. There are lots of primers out there, whether you choose to do Wine for Dummies or the Kevin Zraeli's Windows on the World Wine Course book. There have been for a long time primers for people to read and use and study.
Teach wine.
I'm sorry?
But they don't teach cocktails.
But they don't teach cocktails. And I'll tell you, Francis and I we loved getting your book, not just because it was a new book from Dale DeGroff, but because there was so much of the primer in this book that one of the things we've decided to do, Dale, and I don't know that you even know this, is this is going to become our bar primer in our restaurant, and I'm sure that lots of other restaurants are going to do the same thing.
Right. Thank you very much.
That's a very nice thing.
We're going to require all of our bartenders to know how to make every drink in this book. Well, you know, at
it's
least
no different than the kitchen. I mean, the chef would expect the guy to know what a bechamel sauce is.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Exactly right.
Exactly. Now, and just one final word on the beverage alcohol resource. You give classes in New York, right? The BAR classes?
We do, yeah. We travel a lot with this Bar Smarts program. We're going to be going to probably cities near most bartenders around America. If they're interested in the Bar Smarts thing, they should contact their representatives in their area who handle the Pernod Ricard products, that group of products, and they can probably get a hold of this program and take the course online.
Well, we're going to put up a link to all of that information on our website. If you'd like to meet Dale and maybe get an autographed copy of his book, he'll be at the Catherine Lombardi Cocktail Bar on the 20th of February in the early evening. There's no charge. Just come on down and say hello and have a cocktail with King of Cocktails, Dale DeGroff. Dale, we'll see you on the 20th. Thanks for coming to the show.
I am so looking forward to that. I'm going to bring you some homemade supersod.
Great news.
By the way, for the listeners, that supersod is for me, not for you. Sorry to be.
We're making this weekend.
Excellent. Excellent.
Rhode Island.
Well, I look forward to seeing you, my friend. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, Dale. See you in a couple of weeks.
Ciao.
And we'll be back with the Restaurant Guys in just a moment. Don't go away. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys on RestaurantGuysRadio.com. The Feluga family at the Livio Feluga Winery are masters of modern winemaking and at the same time rooted deeply in Italian tradition. Founder and patriarch Livio Feluga has been counted among the 7 most influential Italian winemakers in the last 100 years. Signore Feluga pioneered the Friuli method. It's a style of winemaking that focuses on the purity of the fruit and the expression of the soil. It's made Livio Feluga Pinot Grigio the standard bearer for high-quality artisanal Pinot Grigio. It's serious, interesting, deeply rooted wine that speaks of the very essence of Friuli, from whence it comes. But with Livio Feluga, it's not only Pinot Grigio. Feluga wines offer a world of adventurous choices. Have you ever had a wonderful Ribolla Gialla or a Picolite? Well, if you haven't, then you're missing some very special Italian wine indeed. Faluga makes red wines like Verdigo, which is Cabernet and Merlot, or Sasso, which is made with the Italian grapes Refosco and Pignolo. Start with Pinot Grigio, the way it's supposed to be, and then, through the efforts of Livio Faluga, take a tour of Friuli, glass by glass, sip by sip. Ask for Livio Faluga wines at your local wine shop, or look for them online. Tell them you heard about it on The Restaurant Guys. Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, stage left, and Kathleen Lombardi. Cocktails, super important book. I can't. It's funny, I touched on it with Dale, but I'm amazed at how many young people who know a number of these fancy cocktails that we wouldn't have known 5 years after we started bartending, because it just we didn't know about bartending history. We didn't know about how to, we weren't using fresh fruits and fresh juices.
Right, and they don't know what a perfect Manhattan is.
But they don't know what a perfect Manhattan is because it's not on the menu. So it's interesting training bartenders now, because we are backfilling. We're giving them perspective, and that's where this book is really important. And if you're going to have one cocktail book, I just want to let people know it's separated into chapters. There are classics, modern classics, martinis, sours, highballs, tropicals, punches, sweet drinks, and then a small chapter on innovation and molecular mixology. Which,
you know what, though?
It's perfect.
The bartenders of today, they're lucky. Okay, there's so much dreck that they don't have to fill their minds with. And you know what? Ask the 50-year-old maitre d' how to make a Presbyterian if you
rusty
need to.
Rusty nail.
Or a rusty nail.
Fuzzy wuzzy woo woo.
Don't even ask how to. Sorry, we don't have. I'm all out of woos today.
Golden Cadillac that. Mind Eraser. Mudslide. What else? Do you have any others? Can you think of any really terrible things?
There's a Marte? Butterscotch nipple somebody ordered the other day. I was like,
oh no, yeah. They did not.
Oh, I swear, somebody in your restaurant ordered a butterscotch nipple, and I had to say, I'm sorry, I'm out of butterscotch and nipple.
In this day and age, really? Oh my. Anyway,
seriously,
how far we've come. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I know that we certainly have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys on RestaurantGuysRadio.com.